There we are. That was Judy Collins, and what a spirited call if I ever heard one. And I think we're going to be joined shortly by Tony Leo. Tony Leo, are you there?
I am, Phil. Hi.
Hey, I outed you as a world-class Scrabble player. This was a well-kept secret, but... Maybe it's not so well kept, but
no, it's not a secret. But.
It's not a secret, but just another side to Tony. By the way, has a wonderful book about the Oshawa General Strike of 37, Baraka Books. Please go and get yourself a copy. Pass it around if you work for, particularly if you're in the labor movement. Urge everybody in your union to study it. Tony, this is a really striking story. You were in Cuba for a Scrabble tournament. I didn't know that they played Scrabble in Cuba. I thought it was an English language phenomenon. Tell me about it.
It's a very strategic mind sport, Scrabble, and almost equivalent to chess or bridge. But it's played in a number of languages, and internationally there are federations for playing Scrabble in French and Spanish as well as English and world championships. And there was a Spanish language regional tournament in Varadero, Cuba, with people from about 9 different countries, and they invited English Scrabblers to come along and join them. Share the space with them so we could, fraternize and get to know each other better. So a group of Canadians went down, and we were there. We were playing Scrabble in English while they were playing Scrabble in Spanish. It was an amazing experience. And, of course, when you're in Cuba, amazing things happen anyway. And although I didn't expect this, I discovered when I was there that the founder of Spanish Scrabble in Cuba, the Cuban Scrabble Association, was a fellow who told me he'd just retired after 38 years working in the international department of the Communist Party of Cuba. So I had a great time meeting him. And I also got to talk to the leader of the Mexican contingent, delegation that was there playing Spanish Scrabble, a man named Javier Guerrero, who had been a delegate to the Legislative Assembly of Mexico for the Workers' Party, the Partido Trabajo.
He's a member of the Workers' Party of Mexico, and yes. he was in. I guess, that's their parliament, right?
Yes,
their Congress.
In their parliament up until the last election. He served a term.
So he didn't. He didn't run for re-election. He served his term, or he's.
I would say he did not run again, as far as I know, because he had been elected on the proportional representation part of their ballot. If he'd been on the party ticket again, he would have been elected again, probably.
And he's, of course, a trade unionist.
Well, that's the...
That's a criteria.
The fundamental outlook of that party is the Socialist Party. They're in alliance with Moreno and support the new president. But it is a party that's, from what I can tell, is to the left of Moreno.
By the way, when you're to the left of the president, Sheinbaum, you have... You really are to the left.
Yes.
Because I would love to explore that, but I guess let's talk about who. How long have they been playing Scrabble in Spanish? Where does Scrabble start? It did start amongst English in English language, right?
Yes. During the Depression. Unemployed architect named Alfred Butts came up with the basic ideas of the game, and it took off in the 1950s when Macy's department store picked it up. And it wasn't until around the 1970s that people started playing it competitively in the UK and the United States and Canada. And in Spanish, the competitive scene started about 25 years ago. The International Spanish-Speaking Federation is celebrating their 25th year this year. Mm-hmm. And they have about 20-odd countries where they have representation. In English, the World English-Speaking Scrabble Association has representation from 30-odd countries around the world. It's very big in places like Nigeria and
Didn't you tell me, by the way, the Nigerians are the best or produce the most champions?
On a team basis, yes, they are the best. The last few world championships, the Nigerian team has come first as a team.
You also told me that there's a, of course, I'm always interested in, you know, there's some rather extraordinary players. And did I get it right that one of them is actually became a champion in Spanish and English and French?
That's right. Nigel Richards is universally agreed to be by far the best Scrabble.
And I think you told me he isn't a Spanish speaker.
That's right.
So explain how he did that.
A few years ago, he decided he was going to compete in the French Scrabble World Championship. He spent 8 or 9 weeks reportedly studying the list of words that is acceptable in French, and he went and played and won. came first. They were absolutely amazed. They could hardly believe it. I think he was able to say merci. And to play Scrabble, you have to be able to announce your score. So he learned the numbers, enough numbers to be able to play. And he didn't know what the words meant, but he knew what the right word was to play to win the games and to win the championship. And then last year, he repeated the same feat in Spanish. Went to the World Spanish Championship.
All the Spanish players must have looked first at each other, then looked at him, and then looked at each other.
Yeah, they were absolutely amazed. And, you know, those of us who follow his feats were less amazed. But yeah, he's quite a remarkable, soft-spoken, humorous guy, a New Zealander who moved many years ago to Malaysia. Lives in Kuala Lumpur, and
he's a New Zealander who works out of Kuala Lumpur.
Yes, yeah.
He's sort of a transient genius, I guess.
He certainly is. Yeah.
By the way, was he at this tournament?
No, he wasn't.
But I suppose that had he been there, everybody would have carried him around the room on their shoulders at least once, just to say, "Here he is." But there must be, aren't there any wrinkles according, I mean, Spanish and French each would have some kind of matter that you'd have to sort of be, the words would be somehow a little different, right? Are there any difference in the rules? The
basic rules and strategy are the same. And if you can learn, if you can read a list of 100,000 words and remember them all and find them all when you have those letters, then you can excel.
Sure, 100,000 words. Remind me to do that.
Yeah, you know, in 8 weeks doing that. And in Spanish, of course, there is a wrinkle, which is that there are letters that don't appear in English. And so when you're playing in Spanish, there's a tile for the CH. And there's a tile for the N with a squiggle over the top.
Yes, you know, the umlaut. Not the umlaut. I forget what it is. Go ahead.
Yeah. And there's a double L tile and a double R tile.
Uh-huh.
So he was able to incorporate that into his study and play with those tiles and play the words, incorporating them.
Wow. Well, I've got the solution here. We're not going to let him play. That's the thing. He should not be allowed. By the way,
but that sounds like what some people want to do with China because they're excelling.
Yeah.
Not let them play. No, no. We love letting him play. He's loved whenever he appears at a tournament because people.
Yeah, that's not fair. You play well. The rest of us agreed not to play well, and then you come along. Yeah. By the way, our partner here, I think, has something to say. Join in. You have a comment.
Yes. I hope you enjoyed yourself in that tournament. You mentioned it's a very strategic game. I had a 3-month interview with a design firm, and the culminating interview day, a full day interview with the finalists. One of the things we did was we had to play Scrabble with the program director and the and another manager of the design firm, and the mental trickery where there was a word that I totally get it. So I just wanted to throw that in.
That is a great story. Yeah.
Well, that was such a great story. I didn't follow exactly. Tell me, what's that point? Oh, go ahead, Tony.
As I gathered, you know, that the person recruiting for the design firm understood that people playing Scrabble could demonstrate strategic understanding and creativity in how they played. And so we wanted them to see them play. So, makes sense to me, anyway.
Yeah. Well, I'm telling you, I think you've sold some people on Scrabble is a growing sport, right?
It is, and
I really liked it. And the Cuba's right in on this that they hosted it.
Yes, and they did an amazing job as hosts too. It was so warm and welcoming, friendly to everybody, particularly to the Canadians who were there. Playing in English, and in fact, there were two Cuban residents who were, not native English speakers, but who made the effort to join with us and play in English. So it was a really remarkable experience.
I think they asked you to say something there. What was that about?
At the opening ceremony, they had remarks from the Cubans and from the Spanish Federation, and they asked me to say a few words, and I thanked them for their hospitality and said that we were thrilled to accept their invitation and were thrilled with the hospitality of the people of Cuba, and that we believed, in the words of Karl Marx, like we worked, that Scrabble players of the world of all countries should unite, which I think they appreciated.
And you could have said you have nothing to lose but your pieces.
That's right, yeah.
Well, Tony, I'm really glad we talked about this, but now I have to take you to heavier work, Unifor. And I should say Unifor, the whole business of the electric vehicles, the crisis. I introduced the program by saying there was a demonstration on the weekend in Detroit, but also, I'm sorry, it was one in Windsor, and then that other country where Detroit is. Tell us about that and what you make of the activity and the news to do with trade war.
Unifor called a rally for Windsor on Saturday against the tariffs. They bussed people from locations across Ontario. To this rally, had several hundred, maybe 1,000 people there, gave speeches. And it's a spot that they seem to like to rally in, although I'm not really quite sure why, because the main feature of the location is that you can see the Detroit River and you can see Detroit on the other side and the tall buildings. Mm-hmm. But while they were doing that, at the same time, there was a rally on the U.S. side, also on the riverside, and it was a rally against tariffs, against Trump, and in solidarity with Canadians. And it included some UAW members who do not agree with their union leadership and think it's wrong to support Trump's tariff impositions. So it was a remarkable, to me, remarkable demonstration of international solidarity.
Was there media for that?
It was certainly covered in the Detroit media. The Detroit Free Press had a long story, videos, interviews, pictures of the rally. But I haven't found coverage of it in any Canadian media. And I was disappointed that even though they had been notified in advance about it, that the Unifor leadership did not mention at their rally that there was a concurrent rally going on across the water there, across the river.
That is very striking. Here we are. I mean, by the way, the initiative, the official demonstration was called by organized by Unifor, and I'm not aware of any media. I read the major national capitalist media, the Globe and Mail. They didn't say a word about it, but the Detroit Free Press covered it. And they covered both, right? I mean, they were aware that there were two.
Yeah. In fact, they have a remarkable video on their attached to their news coverage where you see the pictures taken from the Canadian side. So you see the Canadian demonstration, and you can see the skyline of Detroit. And then they zoom in on Detroit, and you can see the rally on the Detroit side.
And yeah, both of them denouncing the tariff. That's really
yes.
You'd think, well, there's at least a medium-sized story.
But I thought it was a great story.
It's very peculiar. Now, the leader of Unifor was there. There were chants. I guess there was an official statement by Unifor. So what were they calling? What were they saying?
They're saying they're going to fight against tariffs, and the tariffs are bad. I don't think that they have come up with a strategy to put before workers in Canada that would inspire people or would lead to an effective resistance to what workers are facing at the moment. And I think that, you know, if I would... take my own interpretation of it. unofficially, I think that they suffer from not wanting to offend the corporations that Canadian auto workers work for, and they want to be as close as possible to the Liberal Party and the government of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think that they are doing enough to challenge. The real fundamental problems that exist or present solutions that would require, saying and doing things that would be uncomfortable for General Motors or uncomfortable for Mark Carney, such as calling for public ownership and making our economy less dependent on the United States and breaking our ties with NATO and other organizations that put us under the thumb of the U.S. military, to be frank. And they don't want to say those things. I think those kind of demands would be more exciting than chanting. This is one of the chants that they handed out for people to use. Protect our workers, protect our trade, tariffs hurt the product made.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even understand what that means, but anyway.
Well, and they didn't address their own uncomfortableness in that everyone understands that there's auto workers unions on both sides or work unions representing auto workers on both sides of the border, but they are not in communication. Did the two demonstrations acknowledge each other, for example?
The Detroit Free Press said that the workers on the or the crowd on the U.S. side was very aware of the demonstration on the Canadian side and was waving at it. They sang "O Canada." Their signs called for solidarity with with Canadians and Canadian workers, but there was no acknowledgement from the Unifor side.
And I assume that would be because they were not officially there on in the name of the UAW, whose leader has a problem with this subject because he's supporting the tariffs, right?
Well, yes, there were some UAW members who don't agree with the UAW official leadership position of supporting the tariffs, and there was a broader group of people who were there because they are opposed to the U.S. government and Trump and the tariffs and wanted to express support and solidarity with Canadians. So it was, according to the Free Press, something like 350 people were there. So it was a significant, I think it was significant.
Mm-hmm. And something also in addition here that was striking, probably the best-known labor leader in Canada, according to Toronto Star, he was Canada's number one labor leader. His name was Jerry Dias. He wrote a column together with someone else in the Globe and Mail, and you found that full of striking information and ideas, right?
For a number of reasons. First of all...
Remind us who he is, or was.
Jerry Dias is the disgraced ex-president of Unifor. Resigned when it came out that he was involved in some kind of very shady dealings with corporations and supporting their efforts to sell products to companies that Unifor negotiated with. And it involved having a brown paper bag with $25,000 in cash in it. Was a big issue at the time. But the leadership of Unifor, I feel, swept the whole thing under the rug.
They were going to have a report, an investigation and a report, and explain the whole thing.
There were charges. There were charges against Jerry Dias, and there was supposed to be a hearing by the National Executive Board of Unifor. And they allowed Jerry to retire, and then they said they couldn't pursue the hearing or complete the hearing because he was no longer a member. And then that was the end of it. And then they swept it under the rug. And
so it's not only bourgeois capitalists or whatever parties that do these little shenanigans. Apparently it's a common ailment.
It is, certainly. And I think that it diminishes any idea of democracy or control of the union by the members when they don't get to have that process completed. And one of the unfortunate results of that is that now Jerry can pop up and publish his opinion in the Globe and Mail, and he gets listed as the former president and not as somebody who was found guilty of corrupt practices. And the other thing that's striking about the article is that you see very starkly that his political outlook is also, I would say, anti-union, certainly against the interests of workers and Canadians. He argues that Canada should take the soft approach to Donald Trump, and that he says, well, I'll read the quote. He says, "If Canada can offer Mr. Trump a few symbolic wins," so he's saying, you know, we can give
symbolic.
Trump something that's not, you know, it doesn't really matter much, just symbolic. But what are the things that he says are symbolic wins? Paying more into NATO, phasing out supply management, and partnering on critical minerals.
Partnering.
Things we should be doing anyway. He says, we might defuse the situation constructively. I think that if you give...
He went further than Doug Ford. He went further than Doug Ford, I think you argue.
Yes. It's a complete capitulation. And, I don't think that...
Things we should have done anyway. More soldiers, more money for NATO. Ben, explain the management point.
Supply management, as I think many people appreciate, major parts of our agricultural system, protect farmers and protect consumers by having a coordinated, organized system of managing those markets. And it's particularly important for dairy. And we have protected that in Canada against demands from the U.S. that they should be able to flood our market with cheap milk or cheap eggs. And we've resisted that. And it's been very important that we have, and particularly in Quebec and Ontario. And he's saying we should just give it up, phase it out.
Yeah, the phrase I think you quoted was, he said, things we should have done anyway.
Yes, things we should be doing anyway.
By the way, there is an echo there of what we have two premiers who are rather enthusiastic about Washington. Everybody knows about them, Smith and Ford, where they say, well, of course we should do these things, like the border. Oh, yeah, let's get on it. When, in fact, everybody knows there's no fentanyl crisis at all. But they all played along and said, yeah, well, let's do that. I mean, let's get on that. Mm-hmm. When it was, the point is that it's absurd.
Yes.
So, but they said, well, let's play along with him, and he'll like that. Does anybody notice that Trump doesn't seem to appreciate it when you play? He does not appreciate you anymore when you say, okay, we're going to do that, Chief. All he says is, hurry up and do it.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you've got the next demand because you've shown your weakness.
Yeah. So now we have then let's talk the electric vehicle front. I mentioned at the top of the show, we put 100% tariff on electric vehicles from China, and we don't discuss any other options. By the way, yeah, that's just bang. That's what we're going to do. We don't negotiate with them. We don't see if we can work something out. And I do know that, and you and I have spoken in the past, that they did, when they had a competition from Japan many years back, the 80s, I guess it was, they discussed it, and Japan agreed, the Japanese companies, Toyota and the other one, they agreed to build cars here.
In the United States and in Canada.
In both, yes.
The Japanese corporations opened up assembly plants, and Honda and Toyota are now the largest vehicle manufacturers in Canada.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, they're not organized, are they?
And they're non-union, and they're non-union in the United States.
And that was considered a big victory, but we're not offering that to China.
Nope. 100% tariffs on electric vehicles, and the leader of the Auto Workers Union in Canada, Lana Payne of Unifor, supported that and said, in fact, she would support anything that the Canadian government did against China.
Anything.
Anything.
Sky's the limit.
Sky's the limit. And you know, as you pointed out, that's one of the problems right now is that Lana Payne and others are appealing to the U.S. government to treat Canada nicer, because really we should be joining hands to fight against China. And, you know, that's a serious problem, because that's not in the interests of Canadian workers.
How does that differ from Trump? Because, you know, he's trying to divide the room and says, you're either with me or you're not. And they say, we don't like you. And then they say, let's do what you want to do.
Yes. And then there's no unity with workers. Mexico is the other target, or Mexican workers are the other target, that the leadership of the UAW and the leadership of Unifor are happy to see be collateral damage, as long as it's not them, you know. And so we end up with the sad situation again of workers in all three countries being forced to fight each other for the jobs, and instead of finding ways to cooperate to take on the people who are really exploiting them, the corporations they work for, and the governments that support those corporations. And, you know, and there's no contact. There's no discussions between unions in Mexico, Canada, and the United States. So no attempt to find common interests. And, you know, I think that's the worst possible outcome in this crisis.
You know, the part of it that is so difficult is that for us, anybody trying to be reasonable about this, is that they, I guess we have what they call an ethos. Everybody just naturally agrees that something about the great Asian power makes us automatically loyal to the man in Washington on that question. And but at a time when there is a country, Norway, rather successful economy, rather, well, democratic people, and they didn't buy into this. And talk about them, what they're doing.
Norway's had a policy of supporting the adoption of electric vehicles for quite some time. They've had tax advantages. They've had broad government support for rapid charging stations. And the result of that is that electric vehicles are becoming absolutely dominant in Norway. Last year, 90% of the vehicles that were sold were electric vehicles.
And 90%?
90%.
And they're going for 100% in Norway. In short term, by the way, we're not talking decades.
Well, you know, when 90% of the vehicles purchased are electric vehicles, you're almost there. And it's noteworthy that Norway, unlike the United States and the EU and Canada, has not imposed tariffs on Chinese EV imports.
That must be happy Norwegian workers. You can get a $5,000 automobile, a quality automobile, and they have the infrastructure where you can, what is it, 750 kilometers in 15 minutes, you can get that.
Charge on the battery, yeah. You know, I think that they could benefit from also doing some of the other things that China is doing in terms of equally prioritizing public transit, like high-speed rail and other forms of public transit, which are very big in China and not in Norway. I mean, you know, electric vehicles are not everything that needs to be done, but they certainly are way ahead of any other country in the adoption of electric vehicles in Norway.
I think we're in our, what, our 40th year of our warp speed plans to get high-speed rail?
Yeah, on both sides of the U.S. Canada
border. There'll be a report available in 2 years?
Maybe a few years after they complete the Crosstown Expressway.
Yeah.
Or Crosstown.
You know, I was very pleased, I found this striking. Norway gives you free parking and use of the bus lanes if you have an electric vehicle.
Yes, yeah. There's a whole series of...
Free parking. I'm in for that.
Yeah, there's a whole series of incentives, you know. But that's the advantage of government planning.
Yeah.
If you have government...
Oh, government planning. You said the dirty word. I'm sorry.
I know. I did want to, you know, turn back to Unifor again in case people think that you or I might be exaggerating Unifor's position on vehicles and tariffs in China. I wanted to read a quote from Lana Payne.
Okay.
And this is from also an article that was in the Detroit Free Press that was rather comprehensive and interviewed a lot of people and talked about the differences between the UAW position and the Unifor position. But here's the part that I think is critical. Rather than bickering over who is taking whose jobs, Payne said a much larger threat to the North American auto industry is looming overseas. And then this is a direct quote. The other big problem here that's being ignored while the U.S. is fighting with its neighbor is that we have capacity that has been created in China that dwarfs the entire North American industry, Payne said. We're going to be even further behind, and 5 years from now, much more vulnerable to the incredible industrial capacity China has built up. So the much larger threat, according to Lana Payne, is China. She is offering that really we should be cooperating with Donald Trump in taking on China. And like you said, it's, you know, asking the bully to bully somebody else and volunteering to help.
Yeah, that's, that really needs to be addressed, and it will not. I don't see any political party here. This is election day, so I'll just say I've never seen any political party here that is on the ballots taking this matter up. Instead, they all are just agreeing to growl about Donald, but they, meanwhile, buying into the Cold War theory that we have to target this developing country, which is one of the most popular countries on Earth. In UN voting, it's usually with the majority, China.
Yes.
So, anyway, it's very remarkable. Tony Leah, thank you very much. We really appreciate it. Everybody should get the book, Baraka Books, Tony Leah on the Oshawa General Strike of 37. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil.
Okay, okay. This is the remains of the Taylor Report, and I can tell you Steve Fruitman is coming up. It is 33, 45, 78, and we'll see you next time.